Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte City Council mulls over the $91 million price tag to buy tracks for the Red Line, something that they'll have to commit to before funding for the system is approved, and feathers are ruffling. It's back to school at CMS, and the school board meets to talk about student assignment and magnet schools. That, as a court rules, CMS violated state law by withholding rape and sexual assault records. With 67 days to go until Election Day, the races are heating up, and the polls reveal a slight shift in public sentiment. North Carolina moves from lean Republican to toss-up. Stein pulls ahead of Robinson in the governor's race, and GOP Miller turns a state house race ugly. COVID levels remain elevated, and in their last preseason game, the Panthers actually score their first win since December. Here to talk about those stories and more is Ann Doss Helms, WFAE's intrepid education reporter. Nick Oxner is with us. He's WBTV's chief investigative reporter and executive producer of investigations there. Mary C. Curtis is here. She is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Eric Spanberg is back. He is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And we're all gathered at WFAE's Center for Community Engagement downtown, with a live audience for a very special reason. Very special reason that we'll tell you about later in the program. Stay with us. The city's mobility plan and all of its moving parts continues to be up for discussion. Recently, Norfolk Southern relented after, I think, two decades of saying no. They said, yes, you can have the daggone tracks, the O-line tracks, which we will now put the Red Line on. But the price tag is $91 million, which sounds like a lot of money, but it pales in comparison to the total cost of the entire plan, which is $25 billion.
That's Mike Collins' money. Sorry, that was loud, yeah. But that is Mike Collins' money.
So what has the reaction been by members of council to the $91 million price tag for the Red Line tracks, which they will have to vote on September the 3rd?
I think it was there were a lot of questions, of course, and there were some comments to the effect, and we see this every time there's a big controversial issue in local government. Why do we have to vote so fast? Because one glaring obvious part of this is that for the past month or so, city council and or city staff, I should say, have been repeating this mantra that Norfolk Southern has said we have to have a decision by September 9th. Nobody knows why. It's just September 9th. There's just this random date out there, and so that requires a vote next Tuesday so they can do the other pieces of this. And so that was one part of the conversation. Another part of the conversation, of course, which I'm sure we're going to get to a number of clips on this, is the whole bus rapid transit service versus light rail from Matthews to Uptown, yeah, on the Silver Line, and how come the Red Line will get its full funding and move forward. So we see a lot of politics involved in this as it's moving
forward.
And
we will cover that thoroughly in a moment here. the plan is, the transit plan was revised for the umpteenth time because legislative leaders said it focuses too much on trains and not enough on roads. So now it is a roads first plan. So there's less money for trains. Is that why you can't do both the entire Silver Line and the Red Line at the same time?
The short answer is yes, but of course, we're on public radio, so we can't have a short answer. So the other piece of this, Mike, is that with the transit plan, it actually has not been revamped. That's one of the things that will happen between January and July of next year. But what has been revamped is the allocation of the tax money, which is now 40%, 40%, and 20%, respectively, for roads, rail transit, and buses.
And we got into a little bit of this earlier this week with several people who are involved. Lee Altman, who chairs the Metropolitan Transit Commission, and Ed Driggs, who is the chair of the Transportation Committee on City Council, and other folks were with us. And this reminds me very much of the arts proposal that they tried to put forth. We don't know exactly how we're going to spend this money, but please say yes and vote for it. And, of course, the voters said no. And this plan is still in flux. The Silver Line, as you say, is still in it, though it's likely not going to be built because of restrictions on money. Are voters likely to say yes next November? Oh, well, that's the other thing. We'll talk about this is so complex. Voters likely to say yes to a plan that's still in flux?
So let's start with that piece that you're talking about. Between January and July, what I just mentioned, that is going to be the most important period for the life of this proposal, because during that time, the public is going to have its chance to say what they like, what they don't like. By the way, I'm just going to spoiler alert. I bet the people in Matthews are going to say they don't like buses. But anyway, so we'll go through that for 6 months. And the idea is, can the business community, can the political community, the people that support this, can they get the word out and convince people that this is worth voting for? Part two of that, real quickly, Mike, is that at the council meeting this week, Marcus Jones said something, the city manager said something really interesting. He said, this might not be the first bite at the apple. And he was referring to maybe there would have to be a second referendum. And that's what you've seen happen in other cities, including Austin. And now there's one coming up in Nashville, where they've had these big transit, ambitious transit plans. They failed, and then they have to go back to the voters.
Well, since we've been talking about this plan for, I think, 20 years, mm-hmm. will any of us be alive when they go back to the apple?
Well, now let's do some actuarial tables. I'm going to say that Nick will be alive.
I'll actually be hosting Charlotte Talks. Wow.
So.
Sorry. Mary will be alive too. Mary will be alive.
I'm not sure I like the sound of it. I don't like the sound of any of this. Council will vote on and commit to spending $91 million to buy the railroad tracks the O-Line runs on now for the Red Line. And they're going to do this before citizens vote, if in fact they vote, mm-hmm. on November of 2025. So we're committing $91 million before we have any money to pay for it. And we spoke about this earlier this week on this program, and I asked Ed Driggs, the chair of the City Council's Transportation Committee, what would happen if we bought the tracks and then voters said no to raising the sales tax?
Let's say there's a 30% chance that we do not get a referendum passed in ever, like that we try a couple of times and it just doesn't happen. We end up owning that land. And let's say we take a 30% loss when we sell the land. There's an expected value of about $8 million in terms of not being able to complete at all. And frankly, if we're in a position where nothing gets passed and we have no plan, we have no resources, we've got much bigger problems than the expected cost of a failure.
So I should have asked him, but I didn't, so I'll ask you. Do you understand that calculation?
Sort of, yeah. I think what he's doing is calculating, you know, what they're putting in, the estimated loss when they go to sell it, and saying, look, I'm willing to gamble this because this is such an overarching need that it's highly unlikely that we collectively as a community are not going to do something.
So as you reported recently in the Business Journal, the Red Line is the only project specifically mentioned in the draft bill resolution, which we're sending to the legislature to propose this tax increase. And council would approve that, then send it to the General Assembly for approval this November, paving the way for a vote next November. And although the Silver Line is still officially in the plan, that's a pretty good indication that it's getting the axe, right?
Yeah. As everybody keeps putting it, it's a matter of math. That means we don't have enough money.
And in that same article that you wrote for the Business Journal, you stated that the Red Line is definitely in, half the Silver Line is definitely out. What are you talking about? What half?
What am I talking about? the Red Line, this is, and it's funny because we start talking about transit and people start saying, well, we've got to do this for policy reasons, for community reasons. It's political, right? Of course. Nick is shocked in particular. So the Red Line, you can't even talk about this without having the support of North Meck. And the towns in North Meck have said, absolutely not. We are not budging an inch on a sales tax until you give us a tangible project, because we've been paying a half-cent transit tax for 25 years and we haven't gotten anything. So that is why that piece is in. On the Silver Line, it's just what we've been talking about here this morning. There's simply not enough line. The last estimate, not enough money. The last estimate was for $8 to $9 billion for the Silver Line. Well, you're only going to have $17.5 billion over 30 years for transit. You can't spend half of it on one line. And so that's how they're getting to all right, we're going to have light rail from uptown to the airport and a little bit past, and then on the east side from Matthews to uptown, we'll do bus rapid transit service or whatever we can figure out.
So we're playing whack-a-mole here, because as you alluded to, the folks in the northern town said they would absolutely not vote for a 1 cent sales tax hike for transit because they didn't get the train the last time. They have to get it this time, but they say no. Now Matthews is saying no, adamantly no, because they're not getting their Silver Line train. And Matthews Mayor John Higdon was with us on this program on Tuesday. The town commission has already voted unanimously to oppose a sales tax increase out there. And he says he's nearly positive, Mayor Higdon says he's nearly positive that the Silver Line is dead.
I think it's absolutely disingenuous for anybody to suggest that there's going to be enough money to build the Silver Line as light rail in the current plan. That's a non-starter. It's obvious to anybody that knows anything about mathematics that there's not going to be enough funding. So for Marcus Jones or anybody else to insinuate, oh, maybe we will build light rail in Matthews. Not with this plan. There's not enough funding. And so I'm really getting tired of folks saying, well, hey, we haven't really decided. Yes, you have. If this passes, we will not have light rail in Matthews, and that's not acceptable.
But Ed Driggs felt it was a mischaracterization to say that someone decided not to proceed with the Silver Line. It's just a budgetary reality.
There's a difference between recognizing that the implication of what the legislature said is, as you just pointed out, that there isn't going to be enough money, and suggesting that somebody had actually made a decision to cut the Silver Line. It was just something that appeared to be obvious from the fact that the rail money was cut in half.
So Matthews is not on board. That is the bottom line here. And Mayor John Higdon and the board are upset about three things. One, the possibility of no Silver Line coming to Matthews. Two, replacing the train with that dreaded thing, bus rapid transit, which he does not believe will ever be delivered.
And I find it somewhat ironic that everybody in the county that's telling me how great BRT is going to be are getting trains. And they're telling Matthews and East Charlotte to be happy with BRT. BRT has not been built successfully in North America anywhere. The closest is Cleveland, Ohio, and they scored a 63 out of 100 from the Institute of Transportation and Development Policy ratings.
And the chair of the Metropolitan Transit Commission, Lee Altman, was with us that day on the program, and she wanted to set the record straight about bus rapid transit, BRT.
Let's just take a step back and explain what BRT is. It's not CATS Plus. It's not a bus, you know, with some frills around it. It would be dedicated lanes with their dedicated signaling system with real infrastructure at each stop, not like a bench. It's something that in the United States, not a lot of communities have truly invested in, and it hasn't shown a great deal of success. But outside of the United States, there are gold standard BRT systems that are very successful.
So she and other members of the Transit Commission, minus John Higdon, who did not go, went to Miami to see their bus rapid transit system, which I think broke ground 2 years ago, is not yet running. What did they learn?
We don't know yet. We haven't heard what they saw or what they think of what happened. Or at least I haven't seen it. Let me say that. I do not know. I know it was a group of about 25 people. I know Mayor Higdon was not part of it, but most of the people that are involved in the decision-making in local government were part of this trip.
And as we just heard, John Higdon mentioned that the only up-and-running successful bus rapid transit system in the country is in Cleveland. Why didn't they go there?
That's a good question. I don't know how they hit upon Miami, although I will say at the city council retreat in January, they had someone from Miami's transit system talking about bus rapid transit service, and so maybe that was the connection that got them thinking about that.
Would it be possible to even build bus rapid transit to Matthews? Is there land for it, room for it, roads?
There are a lot of questions about that. I'm going to drag Steve Harrison over here in a minute if you keep asking me about that. But yes, there are a lot of questions.
Okay, we've got to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about this and many other things. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks. And the local news roundup coming to you from WFAE's Center for Community Engagement with Eric Spanberg, the managing editor of the Business Journal. He's the only person who has spoken so far, but we'll bring in Mary C. Curtis in a moment from Roll Call, WBTV's Nick Oxner, and our own Ann Doss Helms, our education reporter. We're going to wrap up this transit section here in a second, but I said that Mayor John Higdon of Matthews and his board are upset by three things. The first thing is the fact that they're not going to get the Silver Line. The second is bus rapid transit. And the third is the fact that the most recent plan includes the idea of building a Red Line station in Mooresville, which would cost tens of millions of dollars.
And the last time I checked, you know, I love the folks in Mooresville, but they're not in Mecklenburg County, and they won't be paying one dime towards this tax. And that's the ultimate, you know, adding insult to injury, giving Matthews bus rapid transit while we're building a train station in another county that's not paying for it. That is absolutely ridiculous.
And it would cost $17 million, but Ed Driggs was quick to point out that this is far from decided.
Our deal with Norfolk Southern includes an option to buy the Iredell County portion of the line. The option will not be exercised unless we come to terms with Mooresville and Iredell County on how that's going to work. And I think that's going to include a conversation about their participation. It's not an outright gift, and we are not committing the money for the Iredell County portion of the Red Line yet.
So when the Red Line was not on the drawing boards, the northern town said, no, we will not vote for a sales tax. Now they're saying the same thing in Matthews about the Silver Line. Do they have the same kind of heft?
No.
Should they? Well, why not? Because it's not just Matthews. It's the entire east side.
I think the reason is they're just not as politically aligned, and they have not had 25 years to stew on it. So that's why they're not as politically aligned. And it's interesting, you played a couple of clips there from Ed Driggs. He said the other night during the council meeting something to the effect of, we're concerned what we're hearing from Matthews, but I've spoken with state lawmakers, and it's not enough to, God, horrible pun, derail this. So I had to do it, Nick. I'm sorry. You know, it is interesting, as you said, Matthews has already come out against this, but they know that they have five of the six towns are supporting this, the county is, and the city is. So in all likelihood, this is going to be approved in the next couple of weeks. The legislature likes the way it looks, and so this all goes back to that January-July time period. But real quickly, Mike, and this is kind of similar to some of the things Ann covers, this is all so full of alphabet soup and all these twists and turns and where does the bus go and light rail and do you divide by pi and all this stuff. I think the biggest problem for them is explaining to people what the hell is in this plan, why it makes sense for you, and why you would want to vote for it. And that's going to take a lot of time and, frankly, a lot of money.
And the sad part of this is, in my humble opinion, is that the original plan, which came out in the late 90s, is the only plan that makes any damn sense. And that's not what we're going to do. So during City Council's discussion of buying these Red Line tracks from Norfolk Southern, Council also talked about other parts of the transit plan, including controversy over how close the remaining portion of the Silver Line train would get to the airport. And City Council's Dimple Ashmira had this question.
I just want to make sure that we have an accurate answer. The way I understand this, the Silver Line, it's not going directly to the airport. It is within a mile or two. Am I correct?
To which the interim director of CATS, who's been interim now for, 25 years, Brent Cagle replied,
it does not go directly to the terminal, but it is on airport property and will be connected, as Ms. Gentry has talked about, the aviation director, via another separate train that would bring the passengers on into the airport.
So, on this program on Tuesday, Ed Driggs, the chair of the City Council Transit Committee, repeated that same allegation that there would be a second train, a people mover. Correct me if I'm wrong, the airport runs the airport. They've said nothing about any of this, have they?
The airport is in favor of what's being discussed there, yes. They're okay with that. again, I have to mention Steve Harrison, the political reporter for WFA, because if you need entertainment beyond this, Steve Harrison and Brent Cagle, the interim CATS director, discussing the difference between direct transit service to the airport is really a conversation for the ages, and it will be occurring many times in the next few years.
Okay, and the final question about this transit portion of this program today, the part of the Silver Line that would go to the airport is called Silver Line West, but there would be no Silver Line East.
Well, not with that attitude, Mike.
So the question here is,
it's all about branding.
Why do they think it's better to take a train from uptown to the airport but not go to the airport than it is to take a train from uptown to Matthews, where people might want to commute?
My head is hurting so badly right now. Those are the kinds of mysteries that I really cannot solve within the realm of this program. But yes, I think that's a reasonable question.
All right, Eric, now you be quiet. Because it was back to school on Monday of this week, Ann Doss-Helms. System started with the teacher shortage. They started with the driver shortage. So what else is new? But how did things go? Was it a smooth week?
I think it was. I mean, I think this is one of those no news is good news things. I have not heard of any big problems. There was a school that had a sprinkler leak about 2 weeks before classes started, and it did a lot of water damage, and they conveniently had a large new school, Bruns Avenue, completely replacement school, opening just 3 or 4 miles down the road. So temporarily, two schools are occupying one building, but it seems to be going smoothly. So I think, you know, there's always going to be hiccups and bumps, but I think it's going reasonably well.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill proposed some changes to certain things like magnet programs, and school officials have followed up on that with the discussion that began that 2 weeks ago, I think, by saying that they are considering waiting an extra year to launch Montessori magnets, the shuffle that would move students around and could leave Dilworth Elementary School severely overcrowded. Superintendent Hill presented the possibility just 2 weeks ago. So why this change now?
That's a good question, because the revised possibility, and the school board will have to choose, and it gets so super complicated. But Dilworth Elementary has seen so many changes over the years. Beautiful building in a beautiful neighborhood, but they keep changing who they're putting in it. So last year it was underfilled. This year they brought in the students from Sedgefield to make room for a Montessori program at Sedgefield, so it's full plus. They were expecting, I think, 740 students. But at any rate, they had more. I think they hit 700. They were expecting 640. And so they had more students than they expected. And then this plan was to bring in yet another 100 students as part of this shuffle from the Marie G. Davis district. And there were a lot of questions about that from parents and from teachers who were like, and this is a school that's landlocked. They don't have a lot of room on the grounds to put in mobile classrooms, which is one way to adjust to that. So people were saying, whoa, hold up. This doesn't make a lot of sense. And if they wait a year, they will actually have a new building built on the grounds of the old Park Road Montessori School, which is being demolished, which is what moved into Sedgefield. Keeping track of all that, if anybody can follow that, good for you.
What has this got to do with the Silver Line?
I'm pretty sure the Silver Line will go. That's how they'll solve their driver shortage. Put them on the Silver Line. So it's all very complicated, and this is really just a small slice of student assignment. This is a handful of changes that have to take effect or might take effect for August of 2025, and you might be like, well, why are they doing this now? And it's because the magnet lottery applications start this fall, so people have to know what their choices are. So this is relatively small, unless it affects your school, in which case it's huge.
And something else that Crystal Hill recently suggested was adding 9th and 10th graders to campus-based high schools on various CPCC campuses. They don't like us to say CPCC,
so we'll say Piedmont
Community College. Sites to expand options. She says that it will help expand options for students, make it easier for them to get an associate's degree in 4 years of high school, and save them some money on a college education. All great ideas, but some board members have some reservations about that. Why?
So there are two options right now. There are early college high schools, which are grades 9 through 12, and that means that when you're in eighth grade, you have to decide to get on that track, and it is a very different experience. It can be great if you are a student who's very focused and wants that smaller environment. It's not great, obviously, if you have been waiting to go to football games and pep rallies and, you know, have the whole full high school social life. The middle college that we have now lets students opt in 11th grade and just do 11th and 12th grade on a central Piedmont campus. And the trend is toward the four-year early college, apparently statewide. And I thought this might be kind of a no-brainer. Everybody applauds it. But several board members said, you know, when you're 13 or 14 years old in eighth grade, you don't necessarily know that you want to do that. And it's good to have that option when you have a little more maturity, when you've maybe spent 2 years at your neighborhood high school and said, I really, you know, I'm going to get that associate's degree.
So where does it stand, this idea?
They are scheduled to have a public hearing on all of these 2025 changes, I think, at their first meeting in September, and then vote at the end of September.
Now, this week, a ruling in a court case handed down by a special master determined that Charlotte-Mecklenburg school leaders improperly withheld records detailing rapes and sexual assaults reported by students. Nick Oxner is here with WBTV. He's an investigative reporter there, and this is a story that you have been following like a dog with a bone for years. And the ruling came as a result of a lawsuit brought by WBTV. You've been trying to get your hands on data that CMS staff said did not exist. Fill us in.
Yeah, and that's the important part, Mike, here is we filed a lawsuit seeking a lot of records as part of my reporting into how the school district responded to reports of sexual violence. And in the course of that lawsuit, we agreed to, instead of waiting to get into court and ask a judge to look through records that CMS said were public or weren't, they said they weren't public. I said, I think you're wrong. I think they are public. That happens all the time. And so we file a lawsuit, and we said, we'll have we'll agree on something called a special master, which is a lawyer that you basically agreed to act like a judge. I'm putting this in layman's terms here. Review the records and decide what's public and what's not public. In the course of doing that, CMS and their general counsel, Andre May, submitted an affidavit under oath saying there are no records responsive to Nick's request for this data. There are no records. So not, we don't think these are public, but special master, take a look and decide, there are none. And they said it under oath. And then the special master in his first report said, I think there might be some more records, but I don't know. Again, paraphrasing. And so then the assistant general counsel, Hope Root, who's doing the representing CMS in our public records lawsuit, she submitted a filing to the special master saying, nope, no records. Well, that was a problem because they kept saying there are no records, no records, no records over the last 3 years. And then this summer, I got a copy of records.
And they had used those records in another lawsuit, had they, in another court case.
I knew these. I asked for records that had been referenced in lawsuits before. I knew they existed because there are references to them in filings. I just couldn't. So I knew when they said there are no records, I knew that that was not the case. I knew that they existed, but I couldn't prove it. And that's why it's so hard to do these public records lawsuits all the time. And so we get the records. I published stories. We all agree, let's go back to the special master to decide who, you know, if these records, I guess we needed a special master to tell us if the records existed or not. So the special master looks, and we asked him to decide, one, were the statements made under oath by the general counsel and assistant general counsel, were they reasonable? Two, should these records have been produced to review? And three, are the records public? So the special master decided the record should have been produced, they should have been public record, and the statements made by the general counsel that these records didn't exist are not reasonable. So here we have the school district who's now been found by...
Is that a nice way of saying you perjured yourself?
That's a big word, and I think that's a question for a court to decide.
I think what they would say is that, you know, there's always this game that every journalist in the room is familiar with when you file a records request, and if they don't really aren't super eager about turning things over, they can be very picky about, you didn't request that precise thing. And what he requested had been produced for, like you said, a lawsuit and an Office of Civil Rights investigation. And it is, he got pages and pages and pages of just these sheets that list, they will list the school where an incident happened, and it is student on student sexual harassment disciplinary data. So it's everything from an elementary school verbal harassment.
Our radio audience can't see this, but there's a lot of there's a lot of redaction.
I'm getting ready to describe.
Anne's making
it.
Great television.
Yeah, I'm going for the live audience here. So what they did is that in the middle there's a bunch of stuff that says the name of the student and the date and gender and race and grade level and birth date. Obviously, that's not public. Nobody would expect them to release that. They would get sued to kingdom come. But what they did is black it out. And so they still were contending that this is, by its definition, a confidential document. But the question is why they didn't take this to the special master who reviewed things in closed session. And if he had said, no, we agree, it's confidential, they wouldn't have given it to Nick.
So you had been saying for years that these records exist. You got a copy of them from an anonymous source. You went back to the city general counsel, Andrew Mays, to ask Andrew,
Andre.
Andre Mays. You asked her about it.
Ms. Mays, we have questions about your affidavit that you submitted to a court.
I'm here for a board.
And ma'am,
I'm talking to you.
And that happened again last month before this court ruling when you asked school board chair Stephanie Sneed why the current board was still refusing to make student safety information public.
We still haven't gotten any answers from you or Ms. Klein or Mr. Rankin or anyone else on the school board about why the district had denied the existence of records detailing where students had reported sexual assaults.
Well, you know, that's a matter of pending litigation, so we'll let that process resolve it in that way, and it will comply with whatever other orders there are.
But why wouldn't you?
That's the only comment I have about that at this time.
But we're hearing from parents and students and community that wonder why the district denied the existence of these records.
And thank you for that question. But this is a matter of pending litigation, understand parents, your concerns, the community concerns. We will talk about the things that we can talk about, but right now we're limited in those things, and so I don't have anything else to say about it right now.
But why can't you talk about the existence of public records, which by law you're required to produce? There's nothing saying you can't release
them. I understand that that's your position, and like I said,
well, it's your position because you aren't releasing them.
I understand.
Ma'am, you're the chair of the school board.
I know that, and it's a matter of pending litigation. As you know, as the chair of the school board, then I'm not going to talk about a matter before pending litigation.
But why is it taken?
Thank you so much for your comment.
Okay, we have 20 seconds, but I have so many questions about that. And I'm going to ask him when we come back, including, is that a reasonable response, given the fact that it was under litigation? And two, have they spoken to you since the ruling came down in your favor? We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup from WFAE's Community Engagement Center on 7th Street. For those of you who don't know where it is, just down the street from where our old studio used to be, which they've torn down in memory of us. Eric Spanberger is here from the Charlotte Business Journal. Mary C. Curtis, who will be talking prolifically in a moment about politics. She's with rollcall.com. Nick Oxner is here from WBTV. And Ann Doss Helms is WFAE's education reporter. So the response that we just heard as you doggedly tried to go after Stephanie Steen on the school board, was that a legitimate response, given the fact that when you asked those questions, it was still under litigation? And have you talked to them since the ruling came down in WBTV's favor?
Thank you for not making me answer that in 20 seconds before the break.
So first of all, let me just say this, Mike. Stephanie Sneed was not on the board when they started all this, when they didn't produce the records to begin with. And so it was a whole different, almost entirely different school board that withheld the records in the first place, and even a mostly different school board that said under oath, you know, that these records didn't exist. That being said, Stephanie Sneed is now the chair of the school board that is full-throatedly defending the decision to say these records didn't exist. And my point that I was making to her in that clip you just heard was that you're the chair of the board, you could just produce the records. She could still produce the records today, which, by the way, they've been ordered to do a week ago, and they just said yesterday or on Wednesday that they were going to start looking for the records, they told my lawyers. Mm-hmm. So they could still release the records. And sure, if you're going to say, let's wait for the special master to make his decision, okay, I don't like that, but fine, reasonable. But now the special master has made his decision, and this week their response has been, again, nothing. Slightly better than when D. Rankin and Lisa Klein literally ducked under the council dais to avoid my questions at a meeting. So, I'm not making that up. There's video. And then D. Rankin, the vice chair, said this week in an email on Monday that he would answer my questions and then never scheduled an interview. And Stephanie Sneed has said nothing now still, even after the decision's been handed.
Well, the system has released a statement saying that although they must comply with the special master's determination in this case, quote, the board is disappointed and disagrees with the special master's determination because at all times during this litigation, we were acting in the best interest of the students by protecting the confidentiality of student information. They added, going forward, they would continue to act in that manner. So what is your reaction to that?
Well, one, there's nothing in that board statement to explain why their general counsel, Andre Mays, and why their assistant general counsel, Hope Root, have said in court filings, and in the case of Ms. Mays, under oath, that records did not exist. There's not one explanation to explain why the school board said for years that records that exist, why they said they don't exist, and no one is willing to answer my questions about that. That is a problem.
And we have a lot of people here from the school system this morning. Maybe they can answer that question before we leave. We are 67 days out till Election Day, with early voting starting even sooner, and the presidential and the governor's races are shifting in North Carolina, at least according to the polls. The highly respected nonpartisan Cook Political Report has moved North Carolina from lean Republican to toss-up, and Josh Stein appears to be eclipsing Mark Robinson in the race for governor, if the polls are to be believed. Mary, should they be believed?
Yes, they should. Remember, not that long ago, after the Republican National Convention, when Republicans thought that North Carolina was all sewn up, and maybe North Carolina wouldn't see so many visits from candidates or so many ads. Scratch that. The latest polls show that the presidential race is pretty much tied within the margin of error. Many even have Vice President Kamala Harris, and see how easy it is to pronounce her name? that she is a couple of points ahead, and it has Josh Stein double digits ahead of Mark Robinson in the gubernatorial race, though I will give a caveat there that that when Roy Cooper ran the last time, at this point in the race, he was double digits ahead of Dan Forrest, and it ended up being, I think, about a 4-point race. Right. But I did speak to Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report, and it has been moved to, you know, a toss-up race. Now, she has said that sometimes it seems that it's harder for North Carolina to go to Democrats. Unlike Georgia, she said, Georgia did go to Joe Biden in the last election, but North Carolina has slightly fewer African-American voters and a slightly greater percentage of rural population. That said, it is going to be a tight race. So we saw vice presidential candidate, Governor Tim Walz, this week in Raleigh at a fundraiser, and also getting some milkshakes at Cookout, I think, with Governor Roy Cooper. And we will see both candidates. We saw Trump here recently in the state, and they will be coming here because, yeah, I think they will also be spending a lot of money. For Republicans, they pretty much need North Carolina to win. And if the trends are going away from them, that doesn't bode well for them around the country. For Democrats, they would like to have it. The last time the presidential candidate won it was 2008 with Barack Obama. But in the last election, it was the narrowest margin for Donald Trump.
And Governor Cooper has said he's getting that 2008 feeling again. Should he be having that feeling? Or is he being optimistic?
Well, I think it's not a replica of Barack Obama. The times are different. This time people know Donald Trump. I think more it's that they do know Donald Trump, and he hasn't given them a lot new, and he still would rather be running against Joe Biden. He hasn't seemed to figure out how to counter the joy narrative, how to counter a candidate like Kamala Harris, an accomplished African-American woman, Black and South Asian woman, and we saw him stumble at the National Association of Black Journalists, where I was attending there. And so he's gone to the personal attacks, and he's attacked her in a lot of racist and sexist ways in a country where female voters are the majority of voters. And so I do think that it will be a very close race. We see the Anderson Clayton, the young Democratic chair, trying to get the turnout up and the registration up. Because in North Carolina, most races are close. And a lot of times, Democrats have had problem with the issue of turnout. But there seems to be a lot more excitement.
So let me ask you this, because the High Point University poll has Kamala Harris leading Trump 46-45. That's well within the margin of error.
Yeah.
But Josh Stein's lead in that same poll over Robinson is 14 points, 48-34. Could Harris benefit from Stein's coattails?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about the whole concept of reverse coattails and if that will work. But another thing that Amy Walter said when I spoke with her was that we live in an increasingly partisan time. So you see fewer and fewer cases of people splitting the ticket. So while it might help in a way, in fact, of getting people out who want to vote against Mark Robinson, and that might help the vice president in her quest, that I would expect those polls to tighten as we you know, get closer and closer, because we, at this point, there's so many people who vote red team, blue team, that you see fewer and fewer of the split tickets.
Meanwhile, some races for the state house have gotten a little ugly, which is nothing new for North Carolina politics, but the North Carolina Republican Party has sent mailers to voters in two competitive Mecklenburg County House districts, alleging that the Democratic candidates are supported by those who want to legalize prostitution and hard drugs. On what is that based? Anybody? I've stumped the panel.
Well, I believe it's based on the progressive wing of their party. There is a, they have been endorsed by groups, and I did not make notes on this like I should have, but it is a time-honored tactic of saying, you know, if you've been endorsed by this group and this is their platform, and I think it is the platform.
Yes.
So they're not lying. They're selectively highlighting.
Well, and it's legalization versus decriminalization.
Yeah. Right. And Stephen Wiley, who's the caucus director for the state's House Republicans, says they are simply lifting language from the Democratic Party platform.
We're just highlighting what their own party platform says. So if they don't like what's on there, then they probably shouldn't have supported the party platform.
He says the platform states, quote, a concerted review of all laws should be conducted to remove discriminatory practices, including decriminalizing sex work, gambling, homelessness, and narcotics use. The two candidates being accused of this are Beth Helfrich, who is running against a Republican for an open seat, and Nicole Sidman, who is running against former Democrat turned Republican Trish Cotham. If both these candidates won, they would jeopardize the supermajority the Republicans have in the legislature. Is that why they're being targeted?
Well, absolutely. I mean, yes, everything is about that supermajority and being veto-proof, and particularly when you look at the polling numbers you just mentioned between Josh Stein and Lieutenant Governor Robinson. Yeah, that's why they're all in, so to speak.
And the Trisha Cotham race has become so personal because, of course, when she became a Republican, that's what gave them the supermajority. So we see a lot of national interest in what is basically a state race.
And the candidates say the platform, the Democratic platform, calls for the decriminalization, not the legalization, of certain drugs, as you pointed out, Eric. Helfrich called the mailer a cheap shot. Sidman said the ad is not serious, and when she was asked if she supports decriminalization of hard drugs, here's how she responded.
Study after study showed that just throwing people who have drug addictions into jail doesn't help them, and it doesn't stop the problem. So I think that what we really need to focus on is, you know, stopping the people who are selling the drugs, stopping the people who are bringing in the drugs and hurting society, and not focus on criminalizing people who just actually need our help.
So evidently, COVID is back. Has it ever gone away? I don't think so. The CDC says COVID-19 infections have grown in 27 states this summer, but our state is likely diminishing in the number of cases. That's what the CDC says. But the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services has shown that high levels of the virus and the bacteria linked to COVID are still being found in wastewater. That sounds conflicting to me. What should we take from this? Anybody?
I'm not a doctor. I don't play one on TV. I can't answer that question.
Okay. Charlotte monitors the wastewater for COVID in four different locations, and evidently there has been a reported uptick at the Mallard Creek location. It hasn't resulted in an uptick in hospitalizations, though. And we're going to be looking at where all of this stands next week on this program, where COVID stands, where the new vaccines stand, where vaccines for almost everything that we used to take for granted are now being questioned, and more on this program on Tuesday.
I'm going to guess none of the four of us are guests on that program.
No, not from your track record so far this morning. And as you know, the Panthers... I know this is going to come as a shock to the system, but they won. See, they didn't believe it. They won a preseason game, their first win since last December, and quarterback Bryce Young led a touchdown drive in the one series that he played. What, if anything, Eric, does this tell us, or Mary, for that matter?
Mary, you lead us off.
Well, I think the new coach is actually happy about it because he looks at the track record of all the coaches we've had. And Charlotte, well, you know, the Carolinas need some kind of good news to look forward to because we don't want another 2-15 season. And Bryce Young is hoping that he gets protected and he can have a few more of those touchdown drives. They beat the Bills.
And this was also the week that all of the NFL teams had to cut their rosters, and the Panthers went from 90 players to 53 players. Head coach Dave Canales says it is a tough time for players and coaches.
It's always been a heavy time for me. I would say about 10 years ago, whenever I first became a wide receivers coach, my wife Lizzie and I just said, you know what? It should always hurt, and if it doesn't, I'm not doing it right. I'm doing it wrong. The connection, go for it. Don't hold anything back for the sake of saying, you know, this guy may not be here.
So let's just hope, a little prayer here, a moment of silence, that they kept the right players on that. Finally, this is a sad day at WFAE. This is a longtime education reporter, Ann Doss Helms, last day. She is retiring. She started in newspapers at various places until landing at the Charlotte Observer many years ago. When was that, by the way, Ann?
1987.
You didn't start as an education reporter there. What were your early assignments?
I was in the Gastonia Bureau, which is why I still live in Gaston County. People always hear me shouting out Belmont. So we had a residency requirement, and I actually covered education in Gaston County for about 6 weeks, and then moved into the features department and did family issues, and then went from there into education.
I got to tell you, your coverage of education is astounding to me because it makes my head explode. And you know all the ins and outs and where the bodies are buried. Through some rearrangements at the paper and some very good fortune, we got Ann Doss Helms to join us a few years ago. You have been an invaluable resource to this radio station. You have the uncanny ability to take very complex Byzantine information and distill it down and make us all understand it, help us understand teachers and students and parents and the thousands of superintendents who have come through here.
A few of whom are in our audience.
Very, very, very quickly, what is next for you? Very quickly, what's next for you?
I don't know. I'm just going to catch my breath and figure out what to do next.
And also, this is a very sad day for us because this marks the last day for Charlotte Talks executive producer Wendy Herkey. She joined the station a quarter century ago in a completely different department, took over as executive producer on an interim basis. I asked if she was going to apply for the job, and she said, no, I don't have enough experience. I said, what the heck are you talking about? You're doing the job. She applied for the job, she got the job, and she's been guiding this ship ever since. Producers don't last long. I think your tenure's about as long as Don Hewitt at 60 Minutes, so you're in good company there. But you have helped us change and grow this program over the years. It's only gotten tougher, and it's only gotten better, and it's in great deal thanks to you. And we want to thank you. I'm not sure how we're going to do this program next week. We're taking Monday off to help you move out of your office, but we will be here Tuesday. It won't be the same. Thanks very much.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. For over 26 years and nearly 6,000 episodes, the Charlotte Talks team has been led by the incredible and inimitable executive producer, Wendy Herkey, who today we bid farewell. Thank you, Wendy, for all of the great work. Best wishes on your next chapter. To listen to any of those past 6,000 episodes or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.